Strategy and Insider, exploring future trends and their impacts.
Hello and welcome to another episode of the Strategy and Insider podcast. Imagine a world where medicines can precisely target specific cells, transforming how we fight diseases. And if you're curious about how close we are to the breakthroughs like these, this episode is a must listen to you. I'm your host, Thomas, and today I'm joined by an expert who is leading the charge in this innovative space. Together, we will explore the fascinating world of targeted mRNA delivery, a field that is poised to revolutionize healthcare in due course. So, are you ready to uncover the future of medicine with us? I would say let's get started. Please join me in welcoming Dr. Kahina Lang, who is an entrepreneur, executive director, and head of next-gen drug delivery at Merck Group. Kahina actually is a strategist at heart, scientist by nature, and entrepreneur in spirit. And she defines herself and her various roles like this. As the head of next-gen drug delivery at Merck, she has spent the past 3 years building an international research organization from the get-go, operating with the independence and at the same time agility of a startup across three continents. And within this in-house startup, Kahina leads a team of over 40 experts in developing organ and cell-specific mRNA delivery with the help of innovative technology. The goal in the end is to bring mRNA-based therapies directly to where they should actually take effect via a nanoparticle carrier. And this carrier is what Kahina and her team are working on. And she will tell us absolutely way more about this thrilling endeavor, I'm sure, in a minute. Kahina, meanwhile, also holds a Doctor of Pharmacy from the Paris Sud University and a Master's of Science in Strategic Management from the HEC in Paris. And not only that, she's actually also a former national gymnastics champion of France. And as you can gather from this introduction, Kahina is a really multifaceted leader on a mission to revolutionize healthcare. And this is exactly what we want to look into. So many thanks for joining us today, Kahina. It's really a privilege to have you on our podcast.
Thank you for having me.
Hey, Kahina, you really bring leadership experiences across multiple cultures and cities, just to name a few like Paris, Boston, Lyon, Sydney, and Frankfurt, while drawing on your Algerian roots. Yeah? So there is a lot of in you. How have these diverse experiences influenced your leadership style? And are there any key moments from your earlier career that still kind of influence you today?
I think being a minority is somewhat the best school to true open-mindedness. I think some people think they're open-minded because they like the idea of being so, but I think you learn open-mindedness by being in a position to be the minority. And when you're the one that's different, the outsider, in so many ways, on so many occasions, that's you really learn how to truly be inclusive with others and be mindful of them. So I learn a lot through my personal experience, and I also definitely owe a lot to my parents who raised me and my siblings with values that I place above everything, and respect, loyalty, gratefulness. They're not just words, they're really deeply anchoring me to my culture. And that's something I think that has been part of my personality as well.
And I was also mentioning that since a young age, you have also been deeply involved in professional sports as a gymnast, training very intensively. And you also won numerous titles throughout your career. Now you're in your mid-30s. You already have a leadership role at a major pharma around the corner of Frankfurt here. Has your professional sports background back from the days equipped you with the necessary, let's say, dedication, stamina, and also resilience to thrive in your kind of your second career as well? Or are these completely different motivations for you from the past and now?
For me, gymnastics was really a true passion. I dedicated a lot of my time to it since I was 4 years old.
4 years?
Yes. I was at practice 5 hours a day. School was adapted to that. It was a special school that allowed this to happen. My family was also organized in a way that my dad could drive me every day to practice. He had his own company that allowed him to be flexible. So gymnastics definitely had a huge place in my life. And it's a sport that requires a lot of courage and also discipline and repetition. There's also an element of physical pain in gymnastics, which I think when you work so hard and you allow even yourself to suffer, you come out with an incredible amount of pleasure when you are landing the new skill. And in our club, we had a system where you would, before you go at something new, you'd ring the bell and then everybody would stop and watch you to give you strength and motivate you, because a lot of the things we were doing were really scary. And we were like 6, 7, 8 years old, really young kids, just throwing ourselves into the, into the air and trying to land on our feet. And that moment when you would feel ready and ring the bell and try your thing and want to, you know, celebrate it with everyone, it kind of has a feeling of launching a product. And there's a big parallel to work life. And I think that's a connection I make. And the other one is with my coaches. I think they really taught me resilience at a time where a lot of kids are having the innocence of children. I think in gymnastics, you definitely grow a lot with that element of failing, falling, also making mistakes, owning to your mistakes, learning consequences of, you know, certain decisions you make with sleeping or whatever it is, skipping practice. And that is, I think, a really big part of the valuable skills that I learned and that I developed in life very early. And I think that's something you just keep with you then for the rest of your life. I think it really shaped me fundamentally.
Yeah. No, it really sounds like, and I'm sure this will tell you also and give you some experiences and learnings into your new job where you are now an entrepreneur at Merck, as said before, where you are spearheading kind of an in-house startup within Merck that is focused on targeted mRNA delivery. And one would imagine that this is possibly quite a comfy position, because you can enjoy the freedom and the startup spirit on the one hand while relying on the security of a corporate background. However, I can also imagine that this setup surely comes with its very own challenges. Mm-hmm. So could you share a bit the kind of the origination story of it, how it operates within the company, within the group, and what typical hurdles you're facing on a day-to-day mm-hmm. basis?
You're talking about the freedom and the comfort. I think a big element was also the synergy. We wanted to make sure that we were building something that allowed us to operate in this kind of hybrid mode where we were agile and able to move faster than, you know, the R&D engine can, which is, you know, by design, the way it is. And we were hoping we could work closely with some of those research groups and patent teams and all kinds of experts departments that we have in the company and leverage that to be able to do things in a way that was high quality from the beginning, if that mm-hmm. makes sense. We were also thinking we have infrastructures around manufacturing and process development, etc. And normally when you launch something so fresh as we were with focusing on drug delivery and lipid nanoparticle engineering, it's rare that you have the capabilities around you to think of manufacturing, scaling, mm-hmm. and production, transportation, etc. And we thought, let's try to leverage that and use the skills that we have. And on the other end, we were also aware that there would be some of the corporate burden that mm-hmm. would exist. And there is some of that. What was important was to enter this effort knowing where the processes would try to catch us mm-hmm. and try to be smart and work together. So a lot of the processes that are in place in the company, they are adapted to certain types of projects that maybe we would not always fall under. So we did make some exceptions with how we were navigating the processes. It's not that we skipped the process, but it's just we accommodated some of the steps. And I think we've done a good job at finding a balance between existing under, let's say, the laws of a corporation mm-hmm. and fulfill all the requirements that are expected from a large firm and still be able to move fast. I would say, you know, it's end year. A lot of people are going through the employee engagement, pulse checks, and some of the feedback that I thought was really satisfying for us as a company and for me as the founder of this internal startup was that I hired some people that came from the entrepreneurship world. So they were used to startup mm-hmm. feel. And some of the feedback they gave was that they didn't feel like they were part of a large corporation. And for me, that's like how we continue to attract those kinds of people, because they come with a certain attitude that we really want in a startup. And but what we need to offer to them is that kind of feel that they're not going to be just buried under processes. So, but a big part of my role is really to be the buffer.
Yeah.
Sometimes it's I call it some corporate crazy, because some of it is very invasive and demanding, but I try to make sure the team is not affected. And that's some of the corporate great, because there's some great things with, you know, expertise and access and visibility and even
scale.
Then we can profit of that and get the best of both worlds.
And I'm sure that there must be people around you that shelter also kind of that bit of unicorn within the group, right? And give a lot of trust to you, because otherwise, I mean, people look at it and see this is inside us. So there must be people kind of supporting this front and center, I assume.
I think when we sort of incubated the idea, and that was an idea that I had proposed to our new science and technology officer, Laura Matz, at the time. She had just taken the role, and Belén Garijo, our CEO, she had also just transitioned from being the healthcare CEO to being the corporate CEO. And I presented that idea to them as I thought we had so many untapped opportunities that were cross-sector.
Mm-hmm.
And especially between life science and healthcare, which were the two sectors I knew best. I think there's much more also touching electronics, but just to speak about what I know best, that's what I proposed. I said, we should make sure we have a corporate wallet that is allocated to that innovation effort. And for a project to be eligible, it should touch at least two of the sectors.
Mm-hmm.
And that spoke to them, I think, very much. And actually, Kai Beckmann was also part of this initiative in the early days four and a half years ago. And he's now going to become our new CEO. So I feel we have had the sponsorship in the sense that the company has been supporting that effort. And I'm really grateful for Laura and Belén's effort to just protect us, especially in a context where, frankly, there were a lot of economical hardships in the pharma industry in the past year. There was all the post-COVID destocking, and so we had to make choices as a company, and somewhat we weathered the storm in a way that we didn't have to touch this effort in internal innovation and entrepreneurship programs. So I'm really grateful for that.
Probably pivoting away towards kind of the technology that you're looking in, because mRNA therapies have captured obviously a great attention during COVID times when vaccines came to birth, kind of. But nowadays also impacting fields such as cancer and immune diseases. This field you're working in goes even one step further, because if an mRNA can be delivered to a specific, very targeted area in the body, it can attack, for instance, cancer cells in a very specific organ without being harmful to the surrounding tissue around the tumor in such case. Could you explain what the benefits of a targeted mRNA therapy is, and both from an individual patient perspective, but also from a healthcare system as a whole?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I think that targeted LNP therapies, they are very much about precision instead of exposure, and delivering that mRNA only to the specific organ or the cells with the disease in them. We really work on boosting the efficiency. We are also dramatically reducing side effects, because every time you can work on the concentration and lower the dose, then that's a positive effect you create. And ultimately, we want to just create better outcomes and higher quality for patients. So I think for the clinicians, what it means is this enables them, like I said, lower doses, but also smart combinations and therapies that are tailored to the biology now and not so much on trial and error.
As
for the healthcare system you were asking, I think for them it's fewer complications. So those are costly, and there's just hopefully less of that, shorter stays at the hospital. And I think there's an element of cost as well, because I think the treatments that are more scalable and maybe also more affordable to manufacture. So that's another advantage for the healthcare system.
So in the end, targeted therapies, mRNA therapies, do require non-viral carriers to deliver them really precisely to where they need to be in the end. You mentioned LNPs, which stands for lipid nanoparticles, that have emerged as the leading type of these carrier types in clinical applications. Could you probably a bit to our listeners explain what they are and how they facilitate an mRNA delivery, but probably also what other payloads that they could cope with through the LNP technology?
So what I like to do is describe the LNP as a spaceship and the RNA as the astronaut, because I was asked a couple times about RNA, because it's RNA therapies, etc. And to make sure people understand that we are really in the business of spaceship making and not astronaut training, which really helps, I think, people to understand. So overall, the role of that spaceship in the astronaut spaceship metaphor is to protect the astronaut, gets them to the right place in the space station, and then only release them. So that's what we do with the LNPs. We just get the payload, so the nucleic acid, whatever it is. It can be RNA, it can be mRNA, circular RNA, DNA, even other things. You get that to where it needs to be. And we are in the business of engineering the technologies that allow to carry them and get them specifically. I think what's important is that the LNP is encapsulating that RNA or payload, and it protects it from the degradation, because that's what happens very quickly normally. And when we get it to the right cell and allow it to enter, then once it's inside, the LNP can then release the mRNA, and the cells can now produce the therapeutic protein, translating that message, and then we can have the desired effect. So what makes the LNP really powerful, I think, is the versatility. Like I was mentioning, all the different payloads that we can have. And one aspect of what we can do with LNPs that we've seen more of recently is the delivery of gene editing tools. And for example, like CRISPR, and also doing some combination of different nucleic acids. And I think we'll see also some cases of utilizing small molecules as payload. So we can do a lot with lipid nanoparticles. And I think the trends that we see in the field right now are leaning towards using more and more LNPs for different applications. So
it's literally fascinating listening to this. And LNPs, I did also some digging into it very recently, hold really great promise. But challenges at the same time, I assume, talking about safety, you know, the tissue that is targeted, the controlled release, some sort of immunogenicity that will surely also be, to a certain level, be remaining. Where do we stand in addressing these issues, and what is your strategy to translating LNP-based targeted mRNA therapies then into clinical practice eventually?
Yeah, you're touching on the challenges, and you're absolutely right. There are many challenges around targeting, controlled release, and so on. Actually, if we're talking about cell and gene therapy, we even saw in the last few months, in 2025, some really big players like Novo Nordisk, Takeda, Galapagos, they scaled back a little bit on their cell therapy initiatives. So I think there are some challenges that exist in the space, and we also saw safety setbacks actually, and that were shaking a bit the confidence in the AAV-based gene therapies. And so that was, for example, the case with Sarepta's for Duchenne's therapy. I think they had this safety challenge. So we have that element, but at the same time, on the mRNA side, we are hitting new records of in the space. We're seeing a lot of acquisitions by large players of companies that have skills and patents and technologies that are going to be synergistic and allow them to deliver their payloads. So it's a mixed, I would say, mixed dynamics. But if we're talking more about the technical side, we've also made a lot of meaningful progress. And I think we now understand much better how the LNP composition, how the size, how the surface chemistry are driving biodistribution, cellular uptake, and immune response. And this is allowing us to design particles that are safer. And we've seen it in some of our recent use cases. We have increased selectivity, and even more controllable than for the first generation system. So I think a lot of what we're going to see in the next months and years are going to be leaning towards the use of more advanced LNP compositions. Yeah.
And is there any kind of expectation until when there will be a first in-human application of it?
Actually, there are several targeted LNP programs that are now in late preclinical, IND enabling stages. So I think the first in-human studies are going to be probably before the next 2 years. There are some clinical studies already that are in the CAR T space. I think they are a little bit ahead of the other applications. Most of those programs are in oncology, rare immune disorders, and genetic diseases. And those are the fields where the local delivery and the strong biological readouts are allowing to clearly assess the safety, the targeting, the efficacy, and that's what we're going to see come earliest in the clinic. And more of those applications are utilizing lipid nanoparticles and in vivo delivery technologies.
So clearly we're talking about the field of R&D, and the R&D cycles in pharma for novel drugs is, as we both know, inherently complex, resource intensive, and quite honestly also incredibly costly. So more often than not, pharma R&D requires really breakthrough innovations which lead to a new blockbuster drug that can actually compensate for all the hard work and the financial resources and the risk taking that went into the discovery and the development process. How does the next-gen drug delivery fit into the traditional drug development process? Is that same, or is there a difference to it?
So you're talking about the cost of drug development, and I actually wrote a paper 10 years ago now about that topic, the cost of...
You write at the time is then the question, yeah?
So... It was important to me, and I was talking to you about like my activist heart, and I thought it was important as I was entering the pharma industry, and this is maybe a side topic, but I thought it was important to understand early when I was entering the pharma industry how pricing was impacting access. Uh-huh. And I was concerned, like a lot of people, let's say a lot of citizens would be that drugs are too expensive, people cannot afford them, or they are not priced fairly, etc. And I wanted to understand that. So that's why I wrote about this topic. And of course, I learned a lot about some of the, you know, evergreen patents and things like that. But what I also looked into in great details was, let's say the cost of the drug is heavily burdened by the cost of R&D of the drugs that have failed. Mm-hmm. And because of that, it is very important that we fail early and that we decrease the cost of doing research so that the few drugs that are successful are not impacted by as many failures. So when I wrote this paper 10 years ago, I was really interested about the cost of research, the impact on innovation and access. And what we indeed see is that the cost of medicine is really burdened by the speed of development and the failures of the other programs. So what we are trying to contribute now with those new technologies is three ways. The first one is accelerating preclinical phase. And it often takes more than 5-6 years to go from initiating an idea to being ready for first patient. And we're trying to get that step in closer to 2 to 3 years. That's already a lot of cost saving.
Absolutely.
And time saving. The second element is increasing the probability of success. And in phase one, you have a lot of failures. That's really draining for the industry. So we're trying to use models that are more reliable, and there are lots of conversations around translatability of preclinical to clinical. So what types of animal models you're choosing. And we're working also with organ on the chips and things like that to mm-hmm. really mimic tissues instead of just going with the mice models that are sometimes not as reliable as some other ways. So that's the, let's say, probability of success part. And then the third aspect is the commercial viability. And I think for a drug to be successful, it's of course efficacy and those aspects that we mentioned. But another one is, can this be a drug, and can this be an affordable drug that is stable to transport, to manufacture? I mean, all the aspects around process development. So that's what I mentioned also earlier about the importance to very early on check some of our manufacturing processes. And actually, that's why we are also in our case specifically, we were able to launch already a few months ago one of our technologies, because we were working on scaling it before it had proven successful. And that's not a very common way to operate in corporations for sure, in startups, not sometimes, because you don't have access to a manufacturing site. And at Merck, we have a lot of competence in manufacturing. We have a very strong foothold in manufacturing lipid nanoparticles. And so we were able to ask those questions early and answer them, actually, and be ready to launch as soon as the science was solid.
And as we talk time, resource, cost challenges that we were just alluding to, how do you navigate basically the complexity that you must have also within your startup within Merck, as you have really interdisciplinary teams consisting from experts in biology, in tech, in chemistry, material science, and surely others involved? How do you navigate this?
I think it's a constant effort, because we have a team that has to speak many different languages. And we have developed this program with a digital first mindset. So we were really thinking as we developed the lab, because when I founded the startup, we didn't have labs yet. We didn't have the people yet. So we were able to design from scratch and say, as we onboard equipments, we want those equipments to be having a certain element of automation, standardization, etc. And because we were having an approach where we were going to do high throughput screening, which means we were going to just test a lot of different things and look at them. And of course, we wanted to put the outcomes of those tests into a model, and that model could only function if the data was robust and reproducible. And so we started with that intention. And for scientists, this was a little bit of a challenge, because they were used to be driving the next experiment by themselves. And they would say, we're testing those lipids with those compositions, and then we see the results, and then we go based on what our own experience is as scientists. And instead of that, we literally implemented those tools and those Bayesian designs and those design of experiment optimization exercises, where another part of our team was not sitting in the lab, but sitting with the data, telling partially what should be the next experiment to scientists who have a default mindset where they think they should know better. And we found a way to make sure there was a mix. There was a mix of, let's say, ideas from the scientist's mind, but also that we would give a shot to what the models were saying. And of course, when you create predictions, you can look at them very critically and dismiss them. And there were situations where we took those predictions and we gave them a chance, and some of them performed really well. So that created that trust into the models, and our scientists were more comfortable, you know, getting some guidance. And as long as they still had a little bit of flexibility to also bring in some of their own ideas. So that's one of the examples of bringing people under the same roof. And then you can add other aspects, because now actually we're at a stage where we're onboarding the commercial and marketing and sales part, where it's like pitch deck and selling and how do we present things and going to conferences. And then on the other end, we have the scientists who are researching. Yeah. And this is all part of the same startup. And in the larger corporation, these people would never speak. They would not meet. They would not have to be too close, because there would be so many steps between and things would just be taken away from them. And the time between an experiment and the result that you get from it and showing it to customers is way longer when you're not in such an agile environment. And we were at a conference recently promoting our offering, and we were able to carry data that were, you know, fresh from 2-3 weeks ago. And we were chatting with other colleagues from the company. And for them, this is unthinkable to have such speed between like the results. The rats were analyzed like on a Tuesday. And then Tuesday next week, you have like a slide where you're showing data to customers. And that's the kind of thing that we are able to do. So it's a mix of complexity, and then also the beauty of really being directly ready to help drug makers to make drugs, because that's what we are in business for. We're trying to help the drug makers to have exactly what they need as soon as possible.
And that also describes a bit, I assume, your job, right? Because your job profile must be kind of your galvanizing between the different experts and needs, and a lot of translation from science to business, from business to risk management, compliance. And I mean, this is all part of the solution, mm-hmm. For sure, right?
Yeah. I think my role currently is an enabler. I think some people see that word as like maybe diminishing, or I don't know. But for me, it's like I'm allowing that startup to exist. And what I do is I make sure that we have the funding that we need, and that we have the people that are capable, and that the people have their attention is dedicated to that vision to develop those drug delivery technologies for drug makers, and that they're not being distracted by anything. And that they have the space, because it also includes, like, we're pushing the walls right now. We have more people in the lab. We need more space. So making sure they have enough space. And I help also negotiate with suppliers, so they have all the ingredients they need to work with, and make sure that we have good terms for those things. So I'm just enabling my team to do great science. And I enjoy doing that, because they are really great at what they do, and they are happy to be in an environment where they get to do that. So I think we complement each other really well.
Hey, and as we were talking collaborations, I mean, breakthrough innovations are often born from exactly those multidisciplinary collaborations. And despite obviously the evident potential of those collaborative approaches, the pharma and the biotech sectors admittedly remain highly competitive with limited partnerships. Mm-hmm. In your perspective, how vital is intercompany collaboration for advancing drug development processes and achieving significant breakthroughs in parts, probably together?
Yeah, I think there are many collaboration opportunities that are not harvested, and there are even easier ones, such as internal cross collaborations or with academia, that are also not harvested. So I'll answer you on the one you're asking, but I feel there's a lot to be done at even, let's say, lower hanging fruits, and even within the country, within Germany, from a region to another. I was traveling to Berlin not long ago, talking with some people there from different hospitals and organizations. And there is a bit of a disconnect sometimes between what's happening in the Rhein-Main-Neckar here, where we are, and also what's happening around Berlin. And those are two very strong regions for Germany in the tech field. And I think, and I'm not alone thinking that, a lot of people I met on those occasions agree, there's a lot more that can be done. So we're trying to build bridges between the two regions and also with those academia. So I think we also have to be realistic and first become better at this before we are effective at cross-company collaborations. But a part of the challenge is being protective of our own, let's say, novelties and competence. So I think from my past experiences, what I've seen be done well is the pre-competitive space collaborations. Those are, there are some powerful consortia be put in place and being productive. Cross-company collaborations, I think we have few effective collaborations, and we have mostly acquisitions in the space, because a lot of people are looking at the delivery technologies as something that they want for themselves, mm-hmm. and they want to have control over. And I think that's something that distinguishes what we're doing at Merck right now, because the technology that we are developing, and it's competing with some of the technologies that have been acquired by Big Pharma. So for example, Capstan technology being acquired by AbbVie, and Orbital technology being acquired by BMS, and Umoja also with AbbVie, and Kite with Gilead. All those technologies, they are being sort of snatched away from the market and then integrated into pharma companies. And the consequence is that those pharma companies are getting exclusivity. It tells us two things. It tells us they believe it is important to have control over those technologies, because those technologies are fundamental. But what it also says is that for smaller drug makers, there are fewer options that they can acquire, that they can, you
work
know,
with.
Work
yeah.
with.
Yeah.
And so what we are trying to do is we're providing Merck Healthcare with technologies that we're developing as a corporate startup. But we also have a strong ambition to provide external drug makers, and that's what we're doing. We don't want to be selfish and just use our technology for ourselves. I think there's so much good to be made from those technologies, and they are platforms. They are not just for one application and that's it. So I think that's a key message that I wanted to share on that topic.
Cool. While we talked about the space shuttles for a bit, let's also probably touch upon the astronauts, as you put it. mRNA is obviously a key component of novel modalities in drug discovery and development alongside gene and cell therapies. These approaches are admittedly vital for treating complex diseases that traditional therapies couldn't address in the past. What current trends are you seeing in the field of new modalities, and which areas do you believe hold the most promise for growth alongside mRNA in the next, let's say, 5-6 years?
I think the growing trend is toward nanocarriers technologies. I think the targeting aspect is becoming bigger, because we used to have some applications where targeting was optional, and that's what we saw with, for example, COVID. And now this targeting element is becoming, you know, the next big thing to have. And another trend is around non-viral approaches in cell and gene therapy. I think this is a big shift we've seen. Some companies are taking a mixed approach. We see some players still working with viral vectors, with lentiviruses, and some players are implementing LNPs, whereas some others have just shifted towards lipid nanoparticles entirely. And that means in the past years, they've been developing their formulation competence in a space that they no longer utilize. And that's why we see a gap in the needs. So that's we are coming in as the partner of choice for them, because we can really provide them the formulation support from, let's say, from designing the formulation technology, and we can provide them the ingredients and the manufacturing and the licenses that they need to take their drugs to the market. So those are some of the key trends, I would say.
And while you describe these trends, such as the significance of in vivo approaches for cell therapies, truly also reflect the value that someone like you, with your expertise in guiding gene and cell therapy startups, is obviously great to have. And this actually is a perfect lead over to a recent appointment of yourself as a board member of Genovate, which is a German entrepreneurship program designed to advance those cell and gene therapies. And Genovate brings together young professionals as well as seasoned experts from science and medicine, equipping them with entrepreneurial skills to foster the translation of innovative research in real-life applications. And the program also connects different science hubs, as you described it before, in Germany, like Berlin, Heidelberg, and the Rhine-Main region, as well as various institutions such as the Charité, Merck, Bayer, and others. How does Genovate support the translation from science to spin-off, and what qualities do you look for any participating projects as you're new in this role?
Yeah, and actually the Genovate call for application is ongoing.
So everybody listening, it's open still.
if you are a startup, a young startup, or more of a late stage academic project that's ready to spin off, you should put your name in the hat. And the way we're going to evaluate those projects, and the field, of course, I didn't mention that, is cell and gene therapy applications. Yep. So the way we're going to evaluate the programs is on innovativeness, technical quality, and drugability, because the idea is really to help patients there and make sure this can be translatable. And what we provide is, if you are one of those startups, you'll get access to coaching, you will get feedback, you'll get also a chance, and that's the most important part, probably, to be pitching your startups, your project, your idea in front of professionals, and especially present in front of a top-tier jury during the Investors Day that will take place in Berlin in June. So that's an exciting platform, and this is a translation from an initiative of the German government, the Ministry of Health. There was a strong intention to really strengthen the cell and gene therapy space, and that's in this context that the Genovate was created.
So concluding on a truly exciting discussion, I would still like to take a look into the future more broadly, while also coming back to the topic of mRNA, because recently breaking data, or groundbreaking data, I have to say, revealed that cancer patients that got an immune therapy, received an mRNA COVID-19 vaccine, did actually experience remarkable improvements in survival. And with the phase 3 study underway, the potential of mRNA vaccines to kind of supercharge immunotherapies is on the horizon. Given their promise to revolutionize cancer treatment through enhanced efficacy and cost effectiveness, scalable production and the like, how do you envisage this shaping the future of cancer medicine?
This is a very interesting effect that we observed, and this is informing us about the potential co-effect that we see from the lipid nanoparticle loaded with an mRNA vaccine on patients receiving immune therapy. And this effect that we see to enhance the efficacy of the immune treatment is very informative about the immune effect of the drug in general. And we are in the process of understanding what part of it is triggering this effect. And most likely it is coming from the carrier itself. And what I find very interesting is that this is something that we see only from the non-targeting effect. And if on top you are able to bring in the targeting, the cell recognition next to the immune therapy treatment, I think that's going to be a true revolution in how we are combining treatments for patients that are really having life-threatening conditions.
No, super interesting, and thanks for sharing. And with that, it's actually a wrap. A huge thanks to you, Kahina, for sharing your really profound expertise and experiences, hands-on experiences, and for your work in bringing the next-gen drug delivery to life. And I really enjoyed your talk about the spaceship analogy that really made it very understandable.
Thank you. I really enjoyed the talk, and especially having this really great view from your office here in Frankfurt. Thanks a lot.
Thank you. And to our listeners, thank you for tuning in. Your engagement is really what keeps us going here. And I really welcome your thoughts and the feedback on this episode, but also in general. So please don't forget to subscribe to the Strategy and Insider podcast for more food for thought around the future of health. Stay tuned for our next episode and take care.
Strategy made real.